This is Mae Warren. Today is January 13th, 1999. I'm in Rockbridge Baths with Edwin Gaines, and I'm just thrilled to be here finally. And you are the son of the very famous Francis Pendleton Gaines. How old were you when he became president of Washington and Lee?
I believe I was about 15 months old.
So what's your earliest memory?
Earliest memory is arriving at the Lee house in our car, rushing out to the backyard and having my mother yell at me because there were two muddy wells in the backyard, uncovered, as I recall.
In the backyard of Lee House?
That's right. I suppose we talked so much about going that the arrival was, it's the first thing I remember, period, I think.
So what was it like to grow up in Lee House?
It couldn't have been more wonderful. There were so many rooms, where the Traveler's Stall was my clubhouse. We had tunnels underneath the house. For instance, the porch is raised. I even kept a groundhog underneath there for about a week of going and feeding him, and finally brought him out, and he never hurt. We had the Lee house. It was very comfortable, very large, and it was just right for boys too. There'd be ping pong tables, even pool table, electric trains, and the attic in the basement were open to whatever we wanted to do pretty much.
So
I might say there was a spirit that I sincerely felt that General Lee was there. And I felt that he also had a sense of humor, because to put up with us in his old home was all right. It was no telling. In the library, in which we entertained most of the time, Mr. DuPont gave us a slot machine. Not a slot machine, a pinball machine, because he heard we wanted one. They were new at the time, and so for about a year we kept a pinball machine in the library. But unfortunately, somebody kept filching the nickels, and so it finally died away. But it was, the Christmases and the holidays were wonderful. We frequently had unusual things happen. We didn't lock the door, or at best we said last one in locked the door. Of course, you never knew whether you were the last one or not. So we never locked it. In occasions, we'd find tourists wandering through. I remember specifically this group. My father was trying to tell them that this wasn't a museum and it wasn't open. And they persisted. They said, just tell us what in the house belonged to General Lee. It's still there. And my father said, the radio. And they thanked him and seemed to go on their way.
That's great. That's great. Well, tell me about your sense of the spirit of Lee being there. How did you feel that?
Well, I suppose one of the things, I kept a daily contact when I was young. At first I took my bear, which was a bear on four wheels, and he used to travel down to the Lee Chapel. Then when I was older and had a tricycle, I used to go to the Lee Chapel. I'd go in and talk to travelers, nothing else, and then return to the front steps of the chapel and return the VMI cadet salutes when they came. They used to salute every time they walked by the chapel, saluted General Lee, and I soon, about 20 years ago, they stopped that. But I would stand on the steps and return their salute, and they would either laugh or something like that. But anyway, I was in contact with, if not Lee and his belongings, Eden Traveler or something, and as I say. And I think the test was, if I did something questionable, I'd either say, is it all right, General Lee, or forget it, you, just please overlook this or something like that. He certainly didn't replace the deity or anything, but I felt he was there most of the time.
Well, he's certainly a presence. I'm certainly aware of him being around. Now, I guess you were too young to really remember your father's inauguration.
I was, but I've since read it, and I think it's just magnificent. Well, you've probably seen it.
Yes, too, of course. But now, an event that happened when you were still pretty young and we started to talk about is when they unveiled the McCormick statue.
The McCormick statue, yes.
Tell me all about what you remember of that day.
Well, I remember that Mrs. McCormick from Chicago and another lady, well, anyway, she usually sent presents to the children, that is, to my mother and father's children. But the McCormick family had been very nice to Washington and Lee, and of course, the Reaper was invented there, and the Reaper set the pattern for the northern agriculture, as you know, so that they had foods and can ship foods to starving places, and it offset the dependency on cotton that the cotton gin had more established in the South. But anyway, the McCormicks were important people. They were coming, and the governor and one of the senators from Chicago came. I remember we had our entire congressional delegation, senators and so forth, and there was the McCormick family. The highlight, of course, was the dedication of the statue that everyone was, or most people mistake for General Lee that hadn't been on the campus. And they were all assembled, and my father was, I'm sure, attempting to give his best. And when he nodded at me, I was to pull the ribbon, and the shrouds would come off the statue. And so he was going along, he wound up. And may I add, finally, that Cyrus McCormick was one of the dearest souls that ever graced the face of this universe. He nodded to me, I pulled it down, and right in the crook of Cyrus McCormick's arm was a great big empty whiskey bottle, to the horror of everyone. And Dean Gillum could not quite reach that point. He was trying to reach up and get it out, but it's so high. But that did little. And I think my father recovered very graciously with saying, maybe we better use some of this corn for something else besides just wheat. But that was one of my highlights as a kid. I think I was about six.
Well, I've seen an album from that day, and there was a pageant that took place out at the farm, the McCormick farm?
Yes.
Did you go out to that?
I didn't. My brother did. And they also had the, you remember, they had the stamp here, the McCormick stamp, commemorating. That was, I don't remember what it was, but had you heard about that?
No, I don't know about that.
Yeah, so they opened sales right here in Lexington. It was in the 30s sometime.
Oh, no, I didn't know about that.
I'm pretty certain it was a Cyrus McCormick memorial stamp.
Interesting. I'm going to pause for just a moment
Well, I guess Mrs. Wilson, and then of course we have pictures all over Mrs. DuPont and Mrs. Evans. And I remember when Ms. Roosevelt came down, and then there was Ma Perkins, the first lady in the cabinet, the few Secretary of Labor, and she came down. And one of the perplexing things was we had upstairs my room, my father's side room on one side, on the other side was the green room and the rose room for guests. The green room was right across the hall from my father's room, which was, it was a big hall, by the way, which was on the front of the house. And my mother had a little bitty room she made right at the end of the hall. It was the smallest room upstairs, but we'd usually get eight people in it, sitting on the floor and everything. But my mother would go down when we're having dinner about 15, 20 minutes in advance to make sure everything was all right. Inevitably, there would be a call from either the green room or the, help, help, I need some help. My father would go over there, and it'd be one of these ladies that needed someone to zip up their dress. Well, it became, all right, Ms. DuPont knew the deal, and Ms. Wilson knew the deal, but then some of the others, I'm almost certain that the Secretary of Labor, Ma Perkins, and now Ms. Evans, I know, they also experienced the thing. And my father got so he would just listen, you know. As a matter of fact, they had buzzers in their rooms, but they wouldn't use them, you know, that went down to the butler's pantry. When General Lee was there, he had chimes, and they would pull these things in the bedrooms, and the bells would ring in the kitchen, and they memorized that. I remember we replaced it because nobody could memorize it. Tones and put in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 buzzers up. Anyway, my father did this so often that he declared at one point that he was thinking about writing a book entitled Women I Have Zipped Up. I told him that wouldn't go over. It'd have to be this day and time, Women I've Zipped Down. I go. He was quite a human person. We thought he was dying of strep throat one time. He was confined to his room. Nobody was allowed in except his food and doctor. He wasn't supposed to get out of bed. And I remember going to the door to see him. And he slipped to the window. I didn't know what he was going to do. And he opened the window, and here was his favorite tomcat, and he let him in, pulled the window, and went back and jumped in bed like he'd never been out. But you know, the roof to the Lee house, the cats used to get up and come in. When we were at Pen Robin, we would not have a key to the Lee house in the summertime. We would go up this big wisteria vine right by what is now the parking space at the Lee house. Get on the roof, and we had one window that we kept the screen unlocked. And so you'd see the King boys crawling up on the top of the Lee house. Okay.
Now you mentioned Pen Robin. Explain what that is.
Well, 3 or 4 years after my father came here, he decided it might be nice to have a place, a summer home. And so we spent a couple of years looking. We almost bought one place right here where the interstate is now at Carr's Creek, big hill, and there's no long hill. But he finally found this one worn down place with 320 acres or something. And he restored that. Some of the board members helped him restore it. And it was a big sort of mansion. You've seen pictures of it.
And did it belong to him, or
No, this was my father.
It was personal.
And restored it. And it became something of a show place in the county. There weren't too many big homes. And we had a tennis court. We had 2 log cabins. One of them was, they think, in the 1750s. The house burned down, rebuilt in 1802. And, you know, with the boys, we had one wing. There were three bedrooms and a small maid's room. And on the other wing was my mother and father. And my mother built just beautiful gardens. They were terraced. And it went up to what we call the Taj Mahal, which was a big house. We should have a picture of that. And then a big barbecue pit up there. We could see 60 miles of mountain. And we had some awful nice dinners and things out there. Dining room, I think, was something like 50 feet wide, long. It was the whole side of one house.
Wow, that's and, huge.
The living room was what we called the morning room, and then my father's room was the whole length of one side. All the rooms were huge, you know. But that's where we loved and we considered. And we lived there in the summer and lived in the Lee house, you know, during the 9 months of school, yeah.
I see.
Then when they retired, they lived there for a couple of years and then moved into town and sold Penn Island.
I see. So it was sold within his lifetime?
Yes, it was.
I see. Okay. Now, you also were around for another huge event. You were awfully young, but do you remember the fire when the law school burned?
Oh, yes, absolutely. My uncle was living with us at the time, and he went through law school, my mother's youngest brother. And so I got a little bit on it. I think, was that fire in 35 or 37?
1934.
34. But I remember everyone concerned about the lumber company over there, and it was burning. And then lo and behold, the law school was on fire, that ugly building. And everybody went from there. Now I could see from the pink room, rose room, I guess it was called, upstairs, I had a perfect view of the law school. And then I remember Cabot, who was president of the law school for a year, my uncle. I remember him saying something to the effect that you noticed nothing of importance burned. The story I had at the time was that the law students disliked the building so much and thought it was such a misnomer that the fire had been started by some students to draw the fire department attention over there. Meanwhile, over at the law school, they carried out all the documents of importance, and all of a sudden it erupted in school. I couldn't swear to this, but that's the story that went around at the time.
There are a lot of stories around that fire.
Had you heard that at all or not?
I didn't hear that anything was saved except a few of the law books. But
well,
I think it was a pretty disastrous fire, but apparently it was pretty dramatic too. And
it was.
So you remember the original Tucker Hall and how ugly it was.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I don't think they ever really established or put the blame on anybody for that.
No, they never figured out either one of the fires. They determined that both of them were arson, but they never figured out who did it.
It was a tremendous blaze. Well, I guess a library wouldn't have.
Now, when we talked last summer, you were telling me some wonderful stories about various people who were visitors at Lee House, and you've already started to mention, you mentioned Mrs. Wilson. Was that Mrs. Woodrow Wilson you've been talking about?
Oh, yeah, she was at...
Tell me about her connection to your family.
Well, Mrs. Wilson had been a friend of Mrs. DuPont's. Now, I think they all came from Virginia there. Mrs. DuPont had been a school teacher there in Whitfield, I believe it was, and I believe Ms. Wilson also had This is the second Miss Wilson we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Edith Bowen. Anyway, Miss Edith and my mother and father hit it off pretty well through Miss DuPont, pretty well. And she used to come down. She came down to my wedding, I remember. And lovely person. This is one story I want you to remember, if you will. When President Kennedy was elected president, then Mrs. Wilson, as was customary for the wives or the to give a dinner for the incoming president's wife. This was a tradition, and Ms. Wilson, soon she went there, she'd been given a dinner by the ex-president's wife. So she gave this dinner for Jackie, and she invited my mother. She even sent, which I foolishly gave away, diagrams of where each person was going to sit. Be Ms. Wilson, there'd be Jackie, and then she put my mother right next to her. The other cabinet wives were also, invited. So they were all there, but she knew my mother wanted to talk to Jackie and put her there. Came back after this was over. You know, I asked my mother, I said, what did Jackie have to say? And she said, oh, she just said, do you think 8 years in the White House is going to spoil John John? Well, at that point, nobody knew. Certainly. Mm. And, I mean, I think one morning I walked down into the library and here was Alexander Kerensky, I believe it was.
You don't know that name. Kerensky?
Kerensky, he was right before the communists came in, he was had a provisionary government of Russia. He had to leave and he went to New York and lived and toured the country lecturing or something. But he was head of the Russian government just a little while. But I mean, that's typical who it might be there. I have a list of all the people, or most of the people that came there, and they signed the guest book and so forth, if you'd like to see.
Oh, let's get that out. We're going to pause just a moment. Go ahead, please.
During the bicentennial, I remember Jimmy Burns, who was one of my father's closest friends, they'd grown up together in South Carolina, came down to make the address. Truman had promised my father he would, and then he couldn't, at least he said he couldn't at the end, so he sent his Secretary of State, James Burns. During one morning, just before lunch, we heard a great commotion during the bicentennial up in the green room. We couldn't find anybody. Finally, we heard the voices go again, and even some threatening voices, and went in the bathroom of the green room, and here were Jimmy Burns and Sam Rayburn, about to come to fisticuffs. Burns was breaking. He used the occasion to break with Truman and denounce the welfare state. But that was a little bit of the bicentennial. But I think that the biographer of Sam Rayburn mentions it in his.
So this is in 1949.
That's right. I was in there helping separate them. It wasn't. And Burns was a great friend of mine, too. I didn't know Raven that much. Or you can take the case of Henry Luce. We were all in my mother's room. That was upstairs. Telephone was there. And Luce had put in a call to his magazine. He was, you know who Henry Luce was.
Mm-hmm.
he knows his wife anyway, you know. But he got hold of Whitaker Chambers, who had just announced he had been a communist, but had named also that Henry Luce, we started to leave the room. He said, "No, I want you to hear this." And he said, "You told me you'd never been a member of the Communist Party, and you have, and I'm firing you." Well, you remember Whitaker Chambers was a Alger Hiss. He put the thing on Alger Hiss, which is right interesting. My father was appointed to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. My father had been more or less a protege of Nicholas Murray Butler while my father was studying at Columbia. Nicholas Murray Butler was president. He had won the Nobel Prize. And some reason or other, he liked my father. I remember my father telling me how he himself, as Nicholas Butler, gave him his German test for his PhD. And then, anyway, they went on, and when Butler retired, he wanted my father to succeed him as president of Columbia. My father had offers at Tulane, Bryce, I think there were 14 or 15 universities. But the Columbia one, they sent down one of the Dodgers, I remember, stayed in a week, and they told my father, "We can't tell you that we're naming you president, but we'll tell you this: if you will accept it, we will offer it to you." So that, you may have seen that all these things came out in the paper last fall, or just things of 50 years ago, that's why I was saying that. But my father wasn't interested in that.
Why do you think he was so devoted to Washington and Lee?
Oh, he was the keeper of the tomb. Just as to him, Lee was what Arthur was to the other, to his keeper of the tomb, I think.
Tell me more what you mean by that.
Well, he saw a great deal of inspiration in the life of Robert E. Lee. I mean, if you study most of the heroes in America, Abraham Lincoln, at the height of his power, he was assassinated. And he never had to live with Reconstruction or something like that. I frankly believe it would have been a hell of a lot better if he had lived, I mean, obviously. But so he became a hero. Same thing with Kennedy. He really hadn't, he had a few months, but he hadn't blossomed, and he was killed right at the height. And so people can imagine what they happened to. General, and this was true with others. But General Lee, I think, is the most inspiring person, or one of the most inspiring persons, because he had to live with defeat. And the manner in which he did it, saying, "Let's heal up our wounds and get together, we've lost," was a very difficult thing, and yet people loved him as much after that as they did before or during the war. He had to live with, really, defeat. They could, wanted to, they could say, "Look, here are 600,000 people dead because of you," or something, mm-hmm. when he was fighting to repel an invasion. But we all have our follies. But even if General Lee went to the Greenbrier or something like that, he was the first to get up and go and ask the wives of the Northern ex-general to dance with him, that sort of thing. And Ms. Lee had a cottage right there. You've probably seen that cottage down in Rockbridge Baths that they call the Lee Cottage, where she came out and stayed when she took the baths. And he was a devoted husband. I mean, the house was built, you know, with the porch around it for Mrs. Lee, so her wheelchair could go around there and so forth. And he spent plenty of time. It changed me, and it's a vast, it's no comparison to the way it is now with some of our leaders, I would say.
So all of this was very inspirational to your father, and it's what held him in Lexington?
I think so. I mean, my
mother... Did he talk about it?
Well, yes. It almost went without saying. I mean, when they first came in, they'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, they'd start walking the streets of Lexington. That's the way they met everybody. And he became... It became... Once, twice, when he received offers, I think my mother thought about going. She liked the idea of going to Tulane and living in New Orleans. But my father just about he talked her out of it. I don't think my father had been happy in New York. I don't think he'd been happy in, but he was a small-time boy. He was appointed to the U.S. Naval Academy Board by the president. He was appointed to the, and one time served as chairman of the Patent Committee. He couldn't screw a light bulb in very well, you know. That was what so... tremendously inspiring, philosophical, humble in the best sense of the word, treated everyone the same way with great deference. And yet, you know, there were some things just like a kid. I'm the same way, you know. He couldn't read instructions how to put something together. He was also a member of a number of clubs. One of his favorites was the Alfalfa Club, which you've probably never heard of, but it's in Washington. And I think it's even more prestigious than the Gridiron Club. They have, I think, two outstanding people in each of 50 fields, something like that. My father was a member, and the Alfalfa Club, I remember. Ben McKelway was editor of the old Washington Star. And he had two sons that went to Washington League, one of them my classmate, one my brother. And he nominated my father for president at the Alfalfa Club, which they did every 4 years. So my father went up there and he nominated him. Then my father made the speech. Now this was a speech that was to be humorous, the Alfalfa Club. And he really wowed him. I mean, his slogan was, "Gird up your loins, we're going to win." And they had to take Felix Frankfurter out physically. He got hysterical, and they couldn't. And the next day, papers, which I would love to get. This is 1948, I believe it was. The Washington Star had the headline, "Gaines nominated for presidency." And, it was all part of the thing. So they've had two presidential candidates in this town. I've often wondered if I could write, I'm sure I could, and get a copy of that paper. My mother had one, but Ben McKelway being editor, he could do what he wanted to.
Oh, I'll bet we could track that down. Now, you were starting to tell me about the famous visitors, and you had this list?
Yes.
And I thought maybe if we opened up that list, that might spark your memory of some other great stories.
Well, Lejeune and quite a few of my Carol McCormick, Jesse Ball, DuPont, she was my godmother. She was my godmother, and Cy Young was my godfather. He couldn't be, at that time, more Washington Way than anybody in the world.
Tell me exactly, what's the connection with Jesse Ball DuPont? How did that start? And tell me about their friendship.
If you'll see the picture, they simply adored each other.
Tell me what you remember.
Well, I remember they'd been school teachers together, and they hadn't been school teachers together. I mean, she had been a school teacher, and he had been a school teacher. And I guess it was through mutual friends. I don't remember whether Patrick Hurley, who was ambassador to China, but they met, and Mr. DuPont loved my father. And they were in some business, in some government things together. Maybe it was Patent Committee of Endowment for International Peace, I don't know. But then, I think after Mr. DuPont died, my father became the man she relied on most of all. She had a brother, Ed Ball, who was a ruthless individual, made a lot of money, and when she died, he took over the she put my father on the St. Joe Paper Company board, which handled all these Chicago, the Mr. DuPont, if I can back up, was the biggest stockholder of DuPont Company. But he had three nephews that could outvote him when they put theirs together, so he went to Florida and made another fortune there. And this was where Mr. Ball took over from Ms. DuPont, and she put my father on the board because he was the only one that controlled Mr. Ball, Ed Ball. I don't know whether you remember it, but right before he died, he was putting armed guards on all the trains that went through Florida because the union were blowing them up, and it was one of those things that happened. But so, the more they met each other, the more they loved each other. And they spent most of their vacations together. And they went, for instance, last time I was in Epping Forest, which is Mrs. DuPont's place in Jacksonville, I was the host and she was the hostess, and that's the way she would have it, you know, we'd all dress up. You'd drive into her estate and be met, and people would take you out, usher you to her salon, and she'd be there, come in, and we'd have a drink or two, and then she'd say, okay, now everybody get dressed for dinner, which was always fun, and be back down here in an hour. And you'd go back, and your suitcase would have been opened, all the clothes pressed and hanging up in there. It's right funny, my first wife had a large foot, so they put her shoes with my outfit, my shoes with hers. But that's the way it went. But before that, my mother and father, they traveled on the Minimucha, which was one of her yachts, and I think they eventually gave both yachts to the war. But they crossed the ocean in it one time, and they then Ms. DuPont became more and more dependent on my father on things. And of course, there were a lot of things that, for instance, my father, because he knew her, and because he's interested in her children's hospital, the first in the United States, in Wilmington, Rockbridge County became one of four counties that had priority for any of their people, children, to go up there. The others, one was in Wilmington, and one was in Florida, and I've gotten where the other one was. But. So people from Lexington can go up there and get priority, which was nice. But it just worked in a different way. I remember she had the bowling alley under her her Namur's, which was a small version of Versailles. She had the gates to Catherine Great's place, I remember. Something else again. And Ms. Wilson loved my mother, and Ms. DuPont loved my mother. I mean, I was amazed. She was out at the Pen Robin one time. It was a hen party. She had some other ladies there. And so Ms. DuPont had them all pull the shades and say, "I want to see who can do this." And she put her leg right around the neck. I was peering through the window, you know, just to the base. Nobody else there could do that.
Mrs. DuPont was putting her leg behind her neck?
Absolutely.
Oh, my God. What a story. That's amazing.
Everybody was talking about that around here for a long time. But she kept in pretty good shape. She was tough. But she was just so lovely to me. And when I was at Converse College, one brother was president of Wofford College in South Carolina. My brother Bobby was superintendent of public schools in Charleston. I was assistant to the president and director of development at Converse College. And so the three of us inflicted a great deal on South Carolina before they finally ran us out.
Well, now, I've interviewed a lot of people who had DuPont scholarships, and they talked about how involved she was with the school itself. Certainly her friendship with your parents was the catalyst, but that Mrs. DuPont was very involved with Washington and Lee.
Well, she, of course, was the first woman to be made a member of the board. She hardly made a move without consulting my father. It was after Mr. DuPont died. Mm-hmm. And when she gave the money for the DuPont building there, that was pretty much made with my father, that decision, because they were so lacking in it, I think. Mm-hmm. And she, if she gave money, she wanted to know what was being done with it. And she helped me through school. From the time I was freshman at the university, she gave me $100 a month And then when I finished graduate school, I wrote a letter saying that I thought that someone else deserved that $100 a month, which it turned out didn't do me any harm at all. I'm telling her that. And you walk into the Barnett Bank building in Jacksonville, it looked like IBM headquarters or something. You never saw such a racket going on there. So she was up on everything, I think.
I need to turn the tape over. Mm-hmm.